Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to a new episode of the New Books Network. My name is Victor Manin, and I am pleased to welcome today two professors, Professor Kirsten Niskanen and Michael Barani, to discuss their new book, Gender Embodiment and the History of Scholarly Persona, a collection of essays expanding on the concept of scientific persona and presenting a new set of historical case studies. So professors, thank you so much for coming on the New Books Network. Professor Niskanen, you teach history at Stockholm University, and Professor Barani, you teach history of science at the University of Edinburgh. But before we start discussing your book, I would like to give you some time maybe to share with us what led you to edit this volume on scholarly persona together. So would you mind maybe explaining how the project came together and what were your main objective as you were working on this volume?
Okay, I can start. I can say something about the project that this book relates to. It's a project called Scientific Persona in Cultural Encounters. And it was a project that was started by me and two colleagues, historian Minneke Bosch in the Netherlands and Kurt Wills in Belgium. And our aim when we started this project was to discuss the unequal power structures in academia, and especially power structures in relation to gender and women. And we wanted to do this in a new way. Instead of focusing on obstacles that women have met in academic hierarchies during the 20th century, when universities opened for women and women started entering universities as teachers and scholars and scientists, instead of focusing on the obstacles and problems that women have met, which has been discussed in much of gender history research social historians have been in this area, history of science, literature, there's vast literature on this topic. We wanted to pose questions about what enables individuals to make academic careers. And this led us to the concept of persona. And the persona concept at that time, when we started our project 2013-14, it had been developed by historians of science at Max Planck Institute in Göttingen about 10 years earlier, 2003. In order to discuss how science is embodied and to make questions about the connection between individual scientists and the content of science. So that is the background to this project that we started 2014-15, and we also employed three PhD candidates. They have now all finished their PhD thesis. And then there were the three of us, senior scholars. And during a shorter time, we also had two younger scholars in our project. But unfortunately, they got other jobs. So they left the project on the way. And this book is the result of the conference that we organized within this project.
Yeah. Maybe I can say a bit how I came to the project and sort of the involvement that led to the book itself then. So I joined up with the work about halfway through the project. And by that point, Kirsty and the PIs had identified this concept of persona, had started to focus a lot on the role of institutional histories and their interaction with gender and these dimensions of identity and embodiment. And that was kind of my entry point into the project. I had been doing research on mathematical institutions and mathematical funding bodies. There was a conference that a lot of the collaborators in the SPICE project were participating in on funding bodies in science, and I was presenting some work on how foundation officers basically built assumptions about gender inequality into how they evaluated candidates. Kirsty, after the talk, identified this as something that would be relevant to the conversations they were having, and kindly invited me to join this the Scientific Persona Conference that was being planned for the later stages of the project. And most of the contributions in the volume were, as Kirsty said, presentations at this conference, which grew out of that broader project. The project also had a really excellent special issue of a journal. Actually, it was two special issues before this book came out, looking at various dimensions of the work, and of course also resulted in some very excellent PhD theses. But this book was taking the focus on these dimensions of scholarship and persona in the context of modern science and modern scientific institutions.
Well, thank you so much for this little history and then this background on the project itself. And really, the book seems to be a capstone for a project that lasted at least 10 years, if I'm counting it right. So what I found, a quote that I found particularly interesting in the introduction, and maybe will help us understand what the ambitions of the project is if you put it more in a wider context of history of science, history of knowledge, sociology of science. You both write in the introduction that you see the history of scholarly persona as occupying a vital space in cultural theories of science and scholarship. Michael, if you want to start, do you mind maybe expanding a little bit on what you mean here by vital space? What kind of questions and perspective the history of scholarly persona can unlock?
Thanks, Victor. I'm so glad that you latched onto that quote because it represents this attempt to distill sort of what the volume is trying to accomplish. And like many historians, and you'll have seen in the introduction, we really like to inhabit puns and the sort of the potential that language gives us to identify different kinds of connections. So the first meaning of vital space is really this space of the living, breathing, the vitality of science and its and science and scholarship and its location in human bodies and in human communities that are defined in this way by their vitality, by their living quality. So we see the study of personae as precisely that link between the scale of the individual scientific worker, the individual scholar, and the institutions in which they take a part, in the broader communities of practice, in the broader world of scholarship, and indeed this much larger scale of the, the universal kinds of knowledge, or even the disembodied kinds of knowledge that that scholars aim to produce. So that's one sense of the vital space. But the other dimension that I think really came out in the conversations in the conference, and as the volume was coming together, And as the chapter authors were reviewing drafts and talking about what the interventions were, was the role of the scientific persona concept and the scholarly persona concept as bringing together a lot of different disciplinary perspectives and methodological perspectives interested in the relationship between knowledge and practice, knowledge and people, knowledge and communities, and taking always with the link of the sort of the living person in the middle, using that as a way of connecting a wide range of different disciplinary communities that the contributors to the volume came from, whether it's from communication studies or the sociology of science or the history of science or the history of gender, or the history, sort of national histories, different dimensions of historiography. And that made it a really exciting volume to work on, about thinking about where the intersections of those different different scholarly communities came together around the identities and the forms occupied by scholars in this context.
Well, I really appreciate the fact that you mentioned the multidisciplinary nature of the volume itself, because at times when I was reading it, I was just asking myself in the back of my mind, am I reading a history of science book? Am I reading a sociology of science book? Because constantly there seems to be so many different input from so many different disciplines that are inside the book. And I think the book does a great job as not necessarily feeling the need to particularly situate itself into one discipline, but to consider on the contrary, the concept itself of persona as the platform that is going to bring all these different approaches and knowledge together in a very harmonious way, I'll say, at least as we are going through all the different chapters. And I think your remark here really is a perfect transition for my next question. And maybe I'll start with Kirsty, but I think, Michael, you can also contribute to that one as well. And it's the fact that and I think you could feel it in the quote itself of vital space, is that the fact that the persona is both, to me at least, a very concrete and also elusive object of research. It's very concrete because, I mean, any kind of social life requires interactions between individuals and institutions, and it requires individuals to forge themselves some sort of quote-unquote mask. But at the same time, it's an extremely elusive object because persona are not ready-made masks, and they evolve, they change, they stand in a very fluid space between social institutions and individual personalities. So how does one study a persona? I think to me that seems to me a very interesting question of methodology here. Maybe Kirsty, if you don't mind, do you mind sharing with us some of your methodological approach to the study of persona?
Mm-hmm. I can start by saying that one thing when we created this project is that we placed the project in the context of internalization of scholarship and science during the interwar years, when international contacts intensified during these years. And also, our discovery was that the shift in European science and scholarship shifted from continent to the United States, and large American funders entered the scientific scene in Europe as financiers of research. And here I come to one of my methodological points, that we discovered that when we were first discussing persona, so we were often discussing it as a kind of personal trait, as a kind of personal qualities, repertoires that individuals have to appropriate in order to perform credible and reliable personality or persona that is accepted in the scientific and scholarly communities. But we also discovered when we delved into this question of institutions that institutions also create persona, of course. And funding agencies create persona, which is one of the themes that is that is in our book. So that is my first methodological point, is this combination of identity formation on an individual level and also the institutions that contribute to creating, shaping, and modifying, molding identities. So that's one thing. And that methodologically, it has in our studies led us to work with sources, on different kinds of sources, from institutions to biographical, autobiographical sources. So that's one thing.
Yeah. You wanted to continue?
No, I give the word to Michael.
Thanks. Yeah, so I was going to pick up on exactly that point where you ended, which is one of the key insights of the project is the role of the persona as this link between the individual and institutional, and methodologically what that means. And we see both examples of this in the volume is some authors started with the sort of biographical scale and biographical approach to understand how specific people, using a combination of personal archives, diaries, memoirs, autobiographies, but also their records of their institutional context, how they created an identity for themselves, and then reading outward, looking at how that engaged with or inhabited different types or expectations or roles or other things that we identify with this scale of the persona. And then a different set of contributions started with institutions and how they define what they were looking for, who they were trying to create, how they created different kinds of templates or systems or structures that people could operate. So as Kirsi mentioned, funding bodies, other kinds of groups that evaluated people. There are some studies that really usefully tack between the an individual person and a specific institution. So a really good example of that is Anna Kavanel's chapter about a specific person and a Hungarian botanist and an association that sponsored her travels how this botanist's travels interacted with the sort of emerging norms and expectations of that institution to create this idea of the university woman as a kind of archetype that was building on and challenging other kinds of opportunities for a persona in that time period and in that space. So often what ends up happening, whether the chapters start at an institutional scale or at a personal scale, is they often end up moving between them as they try to explore where the persona comes out.
I really appreciate the fact that you both mentioned the importance of obviously the internationalization of science, or at least its expansion in the 20th century, but also that you and one of the themes that your book is really addressing is the theme of money, how is scholarly work being financed, and how does that financial force is shaping different personas and trajectories, and I think this leads to my next question, because the book is essentially organized in three parts, and each of these three parts focuses on what you identify as being important contextual conditions that play a role in the construction and reinvention of scholarly persona. And these conditions are travels, bodies, and masculinities. But you talk a lot about money all across it, so I think the theme of money itself is running through all of these parts, and obviously each of these contextual conditions that make a different part of the book are obviously constantly intertwined in each cases that you study, right? It simply is maybe a main lens that each of these some of these chapters are taking. But do you mind maybe explaining how these three parts came about. What did you see in travels, bodies, and masculinities as being really operative lens for the study of scholarly persona? And maybe Kirsty, if you don't mind starting, and then Michael, if you want to jump in, of course.
The first question of travel, people on the move, I think we call it, the first part of the book, is exactly about this theme of internalization that we discovered was important in the interwar years. And our own studies in the project, which is Kurt Wills and Peter Huistra, their study, and also Anna Cabanel's study that was discussed, that Michael mentioned, and also my own study, they all have dealt with internalization, with people who are traveling, with the international funding that creates both possibilities, but also maybe in some cases restrictions. And then one of the articles in the book is also a fascinating article by John Hennessy about the William Clark in Hokkaido. So that was an obvious theme during this time, was the movements, people, ideas, identities moving across borders. And it's also in Michael's article about the mathematicians. And then the second part, embodiment, it's kind of inherent in the theme of scholarly or scientific persona, this interaction between individuals as bodies, habits, traits, what we are as human beings, and the ideas that we produce. Also in a very concrete level, in one of the articles, which is Heini Hakosalo's about the medical persona, where she very in a very nice way demonstrates how medical students really have to be able to appropriate a kind of medical persona, which is a physically demanding, challenging enterprise for the students. And then the third part about masculinities, it has to do with gender, of course, and that the academic environments during these years that we focus on, interwar years and the end of 19th century, were male environments. Women were in minority positions in these in academic settlements. So, and also that the question of masculinity is an understudied part of academic life, I would say. So we thought it's interesting to focus on masculinities and how to create masculinities in different ways, academic masculinities.
I think just jumping in very quickly. I think this is a point we'll discuss a little bit after. But especially the masculinity part, I thought in your piece, Kirsty, I thought it was very interesting because in the case of philosophy in particular, this is usually something that goes unnoticed. Although most of the philosophical corpus and the people being studied are usually male, and this is sometimes a question that seems so obvious that is actually not being addressed. But I stop right here, and we'll jump back in with Michael.
Yeah. So I just wanted to add maybe that as anyone who's put together a project like this knows, there are lots of different ways to organize things. A lot of the chapters cut across the different themes. I think Kirsty's is a great example of one that could have been in any of the three sections. And we've played around with a lot of different schemes of organization, different ways of fitting things together. But I think the structure that that was settled on in the end brings out some of these methodological and analytic insights in this really useful way. So as you picked up on, the third part about masculinities, for me, reading that and engaging with the work described there really brought out the complexity and multidimensionality of masculinity as something that is often taken as a kind of default or background or assumed status in the history of scholarship. And those multiple layers of complexity that the different chapters bring to that question really drew out some of the significance of using the persona concept as a way of interrogating the relationship between individuals and the knowledge they produce. I thought the section on embodiment in part two really came together almost as a kind of back and forth conceptually that, you know, so starting with anatomical dissections and then going to, you know, what is possibly the most opposite thing to an anatomical dissection that you can have, the idea of an inborn sort of mental quality and how these are part of historically a very same period, conceptually very similar conversations, but involved in the creation of quite different kinds of personae and their enrollment into very different professional and academic structures of knowledge making, and then kind of to cap that, to bring that exact kind of dialogue into the present with the much more sociological and philosophical even study by Barber and Ankeny and Pluva and Kondui, that looked at the presentation of biographies online from these public-facing scientists, sort of brought out the ways that that bodies, once enacted or suppressed or denied or conceptualized, and sort of spread throughout the world in this almost disembodied way. And then, as Kirsty said, that first section was really a reflection of, I think, one of the big big themes of the conference that led to this volume that came out in the conversation there, which was this fundamental importance of international movement as this place where money ends up mattering a lot, because international movement, especially in the periods that we were talking about, is just ridiculously expensive as a major part of the material costs of forming a scholarly persona, but also ends up becoming a context where different kinds of cultural signifiers, different kinds of national identities, different bases for personal identities really come to the fore, because moving people from one context to another changes the context and assumptions through which personae are built and identified and interpreted. So that more than, or that really directly, I think, reflects the conversations from the conference that those books came out of.
Well, I appreciate that you throughout the, your explanation of that organization of the book around these three themes that you've been quoting and mentioning the works of all the other contributors to the volume, because I think that one point that's really particularly enjoyable with the book is that it deals with so many different scholarly disciplines, such as experimental psychology, pedagogy, history, medicine, mathematics, philosophy, etc. Since we don't have the time, sadly, to go over obviously all of these chapters, I suggest that at least we focus on your respective chapters and your contributions. To the volume, and I'll start maybe with Kirsty, where your chapter, which is the closing chapter of the book, deals with the construction and the metamorphosis of one 20th century Swedish philosopher, and you break down the persona, and you break down the persona of the isolated philosopher, which I think is such an interesting trope in the history of philosophy, in the history of deep thinkers in particular. So if you don't mind, maybe to just maybe retrace very briefly, maybe the trajectory of that philosopher. I hope I'm not pronouncing his name wrong. I think it's Tegan or Tegan. You'll correct me on that. But do you mind maybe retracing the trajectory of his scholarly persona and explaining what you found interesting in it, and maybe what place does it hold in your own research?
I start with the last question, the place of this chapter in my own research. And this chapter is actually a part of the larger study, which is about the force of money, to put it simply. It's about funding, research funding, and how research funding contributed to create the modern research university, actually, at Stockholm University. The Stockholm University at this time was not really a university yet. It was a poor university college, completely dependent on external funding. And in the 1920s, the Rockefeller Foundation emerged as a research funder in Europe and also in Sweden. And they funded research both in natural sciences and in social sciences. And they basically built social science research at Stockholm University. And this chapter is a part of that larger context where social sciences were built at Stockholm University. There were very few social scientists and very few emerging disciplines. And Einar Tegen was a philosopher. He wrote his dissertation in Uppsala University, which is an old university, a very traditional university, which I explain in the chapter, where he created this persona of an isolated philosopher who was sitting in his ivory tower and looking at the world from the outside. And he very much incorporated this kind of philosophy persona in his own person. So he actually, as a person, acted like a very out of the world philosopher person. It was very evident in his marriage. He isolated himself, writing his great book, and did not have contact with his children and so on. So all this changed when he came to the United States and as a Rockefeller Fellow in the end of the 1940, actually. And encountered a completely new world of socially and politically interested social scientists and philosophers, and took great impact on during his stay in the United States. He stayed there for 2 years due to the war, and he became a pioneer of interdisciplinary social science research at Stockholm University and also in Sweden, and promoted the creation of sociology and sociology studies at Stockholm University. So he experienced a personal metamorphosis.
There is an aspect that really appreciate about your chapters are the photographs, and I thought they were very, very compelling a piece of evidence to seize the persona of the isolated philosopher, in particular I think there's a photograph of him in his study lying down, surrounded with books, and there's another one with his family where essentially every member of the family are disconnected. That's a very awkward family picture, I feel, but that extremely telling because although they are posing together in the same space, they are actually occupying a very distinct space for each of them. And I think it said a lot and commented a lot on everything you were writing about this philosopher persona. Do you have any more of these pictures? I'm wondering again about this question of methodology. We were talking about archives, personal archives. We're talking about institutional archives, but there are also these visual pieces of evidence. Did you find more on Tegan, or is it something really hard to locate?
No, not about his family life, and very very little pictures. Very few pictures, unfortunately. He has an enormous archive at Uppsala University Library. Enormous archive with letters and all the material that he brought with him from the United States when he experienced it, metamorphosis, when he was visiting all the major social science institutions in the U.S. So the archive is enormous, but not these kinds of photos.
I see. They're extremely, I think, precious to you. Again, locate the persona and how it was fashioned. So I really appreciate that they were included in the chapter. So let's go ahead with Michael and your own chapter on persona of the mid 20th century global mathematics. And in your introduction to the chapter, you explain that across their history, and I'm quoting here, across their history in multifarious contexts, mathematicians have been depicted as characteristically young or old, male or female, playful or serious. And I think inside this wide variety of historical mathematician persona, what interested you in particular in this mid-20th century global context?
Yes, that's a great way to motivate the chapter, that there was this particular famous quote that has come to define mathematics in this modern context, this quote from G.H. Hardy, that mathematics is a young man's game. And I think the quote has weighed heavily not just on mathematics, but on the historiography of mathematics. So a lot of investigations into the history of mathematics have sort of taken it for granted that the sort of the natural mathematician, the obvious subject of mathematics, is this playful, sometimes otherworldly young man. And especially in writing popular images of mathematics, or writing about mathematics and the history of mathematics outside of the context of scholarly history. And I think the starting point of the research and the argument for this chapter for me was to historicize this idea and to say, wait a minute, this idea that the natural mathematician is a young, playful man is an extremely recent historical development, much more recent than I think even most historians of mathematics tended to assume or tended to present in their own writing about the figure of the mathematician. So part of the article is to very specifically identify the figure of the young, playful man in this sort of parallel development to the one Kirsty is writing about, the philanthropization of mathematical funding in the 1920s and the 1930s, and the way that certain corporate philanthropy expectations of who is worth funding in mathematics end up being transmuted in this kind of strange, complex way into an ideal for who the standard bearer of the mathematics discipline should be. So part of the chapter is to then draw on a pretty wide literature in the historiography of mathematics, looking at different kinds of figures and identities associated with mathematics, and just to really disrupt the idea that the young man's game has been a longstanding hegemonic cultural persona or identity or ideal, and to displace the idea that it has this longer standing, and then really try to build it up and establish where that idea came from, how it came to seem like the only kind of identity that mattered in mathematics, which I think really only does happen in the mid-20th century, and specifically in the context of globalization, in the conditions and the goals and the ideals that made mathematics also much more recently than people tend to assume or tend to believe into a discipline that has this kind of global dimension. Mathematics has only really had a character, what I see as a global character, since really the mid-20th century. In thinking about, when do we get a world where a mathematician expects their work to be relevant to another mathematician on another continent? That happens much later for mathematics than for most kinds of scholarship, most kinds of science in particular. And then the chapter sort of follows what the implications of that transformation are by looking at a very specific persona that was not identified with a specific mathematician, but rather a collective of mathematicians who published under the pseudonym of Nicolas Bourbaki. So this is a French group of mathematicians, and they are also the subject of a great deal of writing, both scholarly writing and popular exposition in a lot of different forms. And one aspect of this that I identify as important is the extent to which the success of the Bourbaki persona depends on its kind of double nature, the ability of people who interact with Bourbaki to interact simultaneously with the elderly, vaguely Eastern European, kind of gnomic, difficult, abstraction-obsessed figure of the pseudonymous mathematician, simultaneous to their impression of the characteristically youthful, energetic, playful, male mathematicians who collaborated and published under Bourbaki's name. And so the rest of the chapter sort of traces out the kind of the tacking between this double persona of Bourbaki, the pseudonym, and Bourbaki, the collective, the group, and how that shows the kind of power and potential and kind of transgressive possibility that mathematicians found in this relatively newly hegemonic ideal of who a mathematician could be in the mid-20th century, which really, I argue, transformed how mathematics was done, who did mathematics, but also what kind of mathematics they produced. And that's something that that I've taken forward in other aspects of my research program, trying to understand how this global transformation of mathematics in the 20th century really changed mathematics, as well as where it's found and who pursued it and how.
This I really appreciate the fact that you mentioned that this research on the scholarly persona of the mathematician as a young, playful man, although it appears to be still still pervasive today in many ways in mathematics, that essentially your research tries to debunk that and maybe create a new, if I can quote again, create a new vital space for the emergence of new persona in mathematics. And I think that was another interesting tension in the book that I would like to address for this final question. I would like both of you maybe to contribute on that one. But it starts from a very personal note, because as I was reading the book, I couldn't help myself but think about my own personal situation in academia. Being an early career scholar, you're constantly faced with the necessity of forging a persona for yourself. And I never personally really thought about my own position in those terms until I really delved into the book and explored the history of it with all the chapters that you brought together. So for that, thank you very much. But on top of this, I was really interested in what you think the research on scholarly persona could, in which way could it benefit academia in a much more practical standpoint than simply than simply on the, you know, the construction of new knowledge, et cetera. What benefits could it contribute, you think, to the academia in general? Maybe Kirsty, if you wanted to take that one first, and then Michael.
I think it's at least on two levels. Firstly, I think that it's important to be aware of, conscious of, that we create, we shape personae all the time, whether we are conscious of it or not. I mean, when I was a young scholar, I was not really conscious that I was making or shaping a persona of my own. Intuitively, I had an idea when I was teaching, for example, that okay, now I am teaching, I'm creating, I'm shaping my persona as a teacher, but I didn't have that vocabulary, but I had an intuitive understanding that so something is happening here, although I could not formulate it in words. But that's one thing I think it's important. Another thing is that we actually really create and shape our personas so explicitly today in the new media, which is the question that is addressed in the article by Kim Barbour, Rachel Ankeny, Caroline Pleva, Jody Conduit. I think it's a very interesting and important article in that sense. Our institutions create and contribute to shaping our personas, and we also do that. And maybe we should do it in a more organized and conscious way.
Yeah, the question, as you phrased it, Victor, was a very much an alive question in the project as it came together. I think, as Kirsty described at the beginning, this broader project about scientific personae was also a project about that was involved directly in training younger scholars, the PhD students on the project. My own involvement with the project started when I was a postdoc, and then I did a lot of the activity of editing the volume when I was just starting in my first long-term academic position here in Edinburgh. And being part of those conversations that crossed career stages, that were in conversation with collaborators and also mentors like Kirsty, who were really actively thinking about how these kinds of historical studies were itself part of a process of persona formation for the community of scholars involved in the project, really made that idea central. And if I have one recommendation for early career scholars, is find a collaborator like Kirsty, who's just made this such an enriching and valuable experience of working on all the different dimensions that go into producing an edited volume, but from a perspective of mentorship and care and collaboration. It was really absolutely enriching experience for me on this project. I would say, in terms of some of the other dimensions that this work and the themes from the different chapters have to speak to our present moment, one thing that stands out for me is the way that scholars are evaluated, and the way that scholars are sort of sorted and portrayed has really direct effects, both from the stated assumptions and also the unstated things, the things that are not made a part of evaluations, application forms, other forms of presentation and ranking and sorting. So a defining feature of an early career scholar's life is trying to fit yourself into the different categories and boxes and profiles of job opportunities and fellowships and funding applications. And it really stood out for me in this project how the whole mesh of assumptions and ideas about what makes good scholarship and what makes a good pursuer of scholarship have these very far-reaching implications that compound over the course of a career, over the course of one's training. And in across academic institutions, to shape what's possible for individual scholars. And just as a last note, I think for both of us, but probably in different ways and coming from different perspectives, the importance of feminist politics and feminist epistemology as both something that informs how we write and how we research, but also how we approach our activity within academic institutions and within collaborations was a really important part of this project, and I think something that's visible across this book and across the chapters, and taking the role specifically of embodied and gendered identity as something that pervades all the work we do, something that plays out and really sort of highlights the stakes of from the smaller scale to the larger scale of academic work and academic scholarship.
Well, thank you so much to the both of you for coming and discussing this new book, Gender Embodiment and the History of Scholarly Persona. It seemed based on both of your remarks that it is such a wholesome project, as well as an awesome project. If I may play on that. But again, thank you so much for coming. Thank you so much for sharing your insights on the books. Thank you so much for sharing the context behind it and the place it holds in your respective research. Thank you again.
Thanks a lot, Victor.
Thank you.